Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This is CorbettReport.com. I'm James Corbett, and it is the 15th of November, 2012. Today, we are talking in our regular monthly conversation with the Geneva Business Insider, a.k.a. David L. Smith. Once again, he can be found at GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com, and his website will be linked up in the show notes for this interview, as well as his YouTube channel, where you can see some of his commentary. So, David, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us once again.
It's good to be back. Thank you very much.
Well, you are our man there in Europe with your eyes on what's happening, not only, of course, in Europe, but also internationally. So from your perspective there in Switzerland, what is on the plate for this month's conversation?
Well, I think we can talk about the banking situation, which is developing, the pressures that Switzerland's been put under for taxation and related issues, and whatever else comes along. We can talk also a little bit about the extraordinary events in America regarding Benghazi and regarding the philanderings of the upper ranks of the military.
Absolutely. Well, all of those extremely important topics, and all of them very big topics. So let's start broaching the conversation. Let's start by talking about the banking system internationally, and also what's happening there in Switzerland.
Well, looking at the situation in Switzerland, things are getting more and more difficult. The most important event, which has been hitting all the headlines, is UBS restructuring and downsizing by approximately 10,000 jobs. They're essentially withdrawing from their fixed income business, which can be translated into casino banking, and they're recentering their activities on the traditional banking activities, which I think I said in a previous interview, would represent them sticking to their knitting and being good, safe, prudent people. However, the problem with this is that they have got a bit too fat and lazy over the years, and Switzerland's very privileged geopolitical position, where people are only too happy to leave their money for the security of, first of all, the confidentiality, and second, the knowledge that in the event of any major crisis, the money would definitely be there. Now people are beginning to look at Switzerland and say, well, as the borders are breaking down, as banking confidentiality is disappearing, they're looking very, very closely at the fees they're paying, and they're realizing that for a long time, they've been paying twice as much as most of Switzerland's competitors in terms of costs for similar services. So this is going to have a big impact when the restructuring actually comes through to maintain the profitability of the banks at anything like the levels that exist at the moment.
Well, in our email for setting up this interview, you declared it a U.S. regulatory war on foreign banks that's developing right now, and how regulators are basically just a tool of Wall Street, which, of course, I think a lot of listeners will already be aware of. But let's talk about how that plays into this situation.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, it was Kissinger, I think, who said that the military is just a branch of American foreign policy, a rough, brutal branch of American foreign policy. If we actually look at what is happening now in America, we can say that the regulators are being used by the American banks to beat down on the other banks. So you have in the global too big to fail banks, there is kind of an inner circle and an outer circle. And if you happen to be on the outer circle, then you have a big problem. So I think if you look at the activities of all these banks, you take LIBOR, for example. LIBOR has been a global scandal involving all of the banks. Most of the ripoff techniques that have been applied on a worldwide basis, all the banks have been applying them. So basically what you have happen is you have the regulator applying the law on a selective basis and picking victims. So if we look, for example, at HSBC with its money laundering issues, that's one very good example. If we look at the beatdown on UBS, that's another. And if I were the chief executive of UBS, I would be doing exactly what has been done. It said, you know, we got to get the hell out of Dodge, as you say in America, or more particularly Wall Street, because these guys are never going to let up. If you look at it objectively, and trying to put on an American hat on this, I would be saying, as the chairman of the Fed or a Jamie Dimon or a head of a major bank. What we have to make sure is that the only banks left standing at the end of all this crisis are the American ones. So little by little, they amputate and attack the others using the SEC, using the CFTC. And bit by bit, people get the message. They establish a lower profile. They withdraw from certain business lines. The people in those business lines at the moment are just going to be picked up by the banks remaining in the US. One has to say, what's going to happen with the fixed income team in the US, which used to work for UBS? Well, the answer is going to be picked up by a JP Morgan or a Goldman at a knockdown price. So it is kind of like, I don't know, a Maine lobster meeting a small crab and just biting one limb off after the other and the other until the victim is left helpless or has the intelligence to run away before it's too late.
Well, that's an interesting analogy, and you raise the specter of the inner circle and the outer circle when it comes to the global banking infrastructure, and I think that's extremely interesting, because it seems to me that it's not always readily apparent from the outside which bank is on the inner circle or which bank on the outer circle, and perhaps there's some movement between the two. For example, I'm not sure that there were many analysts predicting the fall of Lehman Brothers before it actually happened, and some of the spectacular moves that we saw back in around that time. How can we tell who is in this inner circle, and what really defines that inner circle of the inner sanctum of the bankers?
Well, I don't have the answer to that, but what you have essentially is a group of people whose interests, by and large, are aligned, i.e. the major banks have all of them a solvency issue. Many of them a liquidity issue, and the principal objective is to use the politicians to ensure that laws are and the judicial system to make sure laws are applied in such a way as they can reline their pockets off the back of the taxpayer on a global basis. So if you take that as a start point, I mean, these people are definitely working together like a cabal. However, having said that, once you actually start looking in between themselves, there are times when they are in competition. Most of the times, their interests align against the general public and their clients. But when there is genuine competition and survival at stake, then the inner sanctum changes. Now, I think a number of the banks, what can I say, a number of them, are all set up to fail by themselves. I mean, I think if you look at the French banking system, all that needs to happen is for Spain and Italy to blow up, and these banks, the too big to fail French banks, will be too big to save even by the French government and perhaps by the EU. So then you come back down to say, all right, well, let's eliminate the ones that are weaker and that are not a threat, for example, that or the Spanish banks. Then you have a few that remain to some degree a threat, like, for example, a UBS, which is backed by a country which is not actually as yet completely insolvent, despite the efforts of their central bank. And that, of course, has to be attacked. So I think these pressures, it's like within, I don't know, it's even like a golf club, you know, you have a team of people. You know, they're all members of the same golf club. You know, they're all very good when they're playing their competitors. But when it comes down to the Saturday morning tournament, you know, they're all in it for themselves.
Yes, that's probably a very apt analogy. And let's apply that to to extending that idea that the U.S. regulators are really acting as an extension of U.S. foreign policy. Well, obviously, we can extrapolate that other countries use their own regulatory regimes as ways of basically tools of warfare to one extent or another, undermining some of their competitors. And of course, Switzerland, as you say, has been based on this idea that it is a safe banking haven. But we saw, for example, recently a story come out about the National Directorate of Tax Investigations, basically the French IRS, is now sending covert agents into Switzerland to pursue tax evasion cases and spy on French citizens in Switzerland. We've seen stories like this coming out more and more frequently as the banking warfare, the covert banking warfare, steps up. What does this say about Switzerland and how it's being undermined from the outside?
Yeah, it's undermined from the outside and to a good degree through stupidity on the inside. But you know, this image of, you know, the French coming across the border and monitoring what's going on in the banks is absolutely nothing new. You know, when I came to Switzerland at the time of Mitterrand's rise to power, he did exactly the same thing. I mean, he nationalized the French banks. The immediate reaction was anyone with half a brain who had an account with a French bank realized that Swiss banking secrecy wasn't worth the paper it was written on at that time. So they moved the money out into independent asset management businesses and standalone trust and fiduciary companies to look after their affairs. And at that time, you had the French customs parading around central Geneva, taking photographs. Okay, not digital at that time, but much more obviously. And that created a scandal. So it's not completely new. I mean, Geneva has been a turning point for an awful lot of things from the Oliver North scandals going back to the time of Reagan, where money was laundered through here, et cetera, et cetera. Now, those things have tightened up very, very considerably, and it's not the same problem. But I think the biggest danger these days in Geneva for these French customs people who are walking around trying to take photographs is that they, you know, with the Schengen agreements that have come in, now there's free movement all around Europe of any citizens from anywhere. So the biggest risk you have standing outside these major banks taking photographs is that you get some Eastern European who comes and steals your mobile phone.
Indeed. Well, let's turn to some of the other aspects of what's happening that can play into this overall banking, international banking structure. And of course, we have to look at least at the surface level at the U.S. elections and what did or did not change as a result of that. Of course, we saw Obama maintain his position as president, which everyone reads as just more of the status quo. And I think the markets read into that accordingly. But looking out from here, Romney, at least a campaign candidate Romney, was giving lip service to the idea of canning Bernanke when he comes up for reappointment in early 2014. That seems to be off the table now, although I do think I recently saw a headline about Bernanke saying that he wouldn't stay on for a third appointment, but I'm not sure what the status of that is, but what do you think going out from here, how the second Obama term will look in terms of what's happening within the United States and, of course, how that applies to the international structure?
Well, I think it's pretty clearly more of the same and probably in a more exaggerated and abusive manner. I mean, I saw a statistic the other day, you know, Romney, one of the things that was meant to have brought him down was his comment about the 47%. I think the reality we have now is American democracy has been degenerated to the point where it's government of the 100% by the 47% for the 47%. So, I mean, it's sad to see a country which I always looked up to as a young guy, as a model for the future, just degenerating into decadent socialism and ultimate failure. And I don't see that anything that Obama is going to do is going to reverse those trends. In fact, it's even going to accelerate it. So when you saw the sell-off in the market immediately after his nomination, it was basically because people were realizing that money printing would go on forever, that Bernanke would continue to remain in place and maintain his policies. These things are very destructive for the dollar and very destructive for the debt levels of the country. And although it might give a short flip to the stock market just by the fact you're pumping more and more money into the system, you're basically getting an inflation effect rise in the stock market. You're not really getting any genuine improvement. And the only source of wealth in America seems to be printing money, not creating anything, building anything, inventing anything. It's really a tragedy from my point of view.
And of course, that is all backed up at the point at the barrel of a gun, and that's basically the status quo of world geopolitics for the past two decades. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem likely to change anytime soon under President Obama either. Although there are some very interesting moves taking place at some of his top level positions, including several key military positions, and of course, Director of Central Intelligence David Petraeus. Tell us your thoughts about this Petraeus affair.
Well, I kind of stand on the outside looking in. Obviously, Mr. Petraeus has been rather unwise in what he's done. But if you look at this historically, you know, you go back to the Second World War, and we had Avril Harriman, who came to the UK as the ambassador. He very quickly started an affair with Winston Churchill's ex-daughter-in-law, which went on for a long time and eventually led to their marriage many years later. If we take General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, he also was in the UK and had a mistress who was a secretary throughout the war. And when he wanted to take her home, in fact, it was George Marshall who said, sorry, she's going to have to stay where she is because it's bad for the image. So one thing that's pretty clear about the upper ranks in the military and the elites is that they're no stranger to male hormones. And at that time, when the world was much more prudish about this kind of things, these things were all absorbed and accepted perfectly well. Now, if I look at Petraeus, I just find the whole thing is totally implausible as a story, that the reason that he is actually evicted from his office is doing the same thing as many have done before him. And if you actually were to apply this rule rigorously, then I think you would have to ask for the resignation of, you know, a very, very large percentage of the US and UK and other militaries worldwide. Because one thing that they always have been able to do, they've not always been able to fight wars well or win wars well, but they've certainly known how to enjoy themselves with the locals.
Absolutely so. And I think you're right. I think that does show that this is not just another sex scandal. There's obviously more to it. And as I mentioned, there's a lot of army generals, etc., that are being shuffled and or being stripped of some of their stars right now and or under investigations. And I don't know if that's coincidental or not, but I think it's interesting to take a look at that and some of the potential implications for the second term of Obama. But of course, that's all speculation at this point. And if you'd care to speculate on any of that, I'd be interested to hear it. If not, we can move on.
Well, I think if you look at the environment that this has created, you have a very large number of people who are not innocent in these matters, who can be brought down by these matters. So for me, as an external observer, this looks more like intimidation of the military class than it does look like dealing with an issue which could have threatened national security. Then you have to say, well, why would a president and his team want to intimidate the military? And then you start coming into speculation. But I mean, to me, I'm not sure that the very left-wing policies of Obama sit all that well with the military elite. And there must be a great deal of discomfiture about that. I'm not sure that the NDAA, which was passed last year, which gives the president power to use the military to essentially oppress the public, is something that the upper ranks of the military would like either, because, you know, it's one thing fighting a war with missiles at a distance. It's another thing ordering your troops into their hometowns to, you know, perhaps shoot up or damage the interests of people locally. So, I mean, to me, it smells at a distance of intimidation, and maybe the shakedown will be achieved in such a way as to put people who are more like-minded in stronger positions. You actually look at what happened, for example, in Hitler's Germany. This was how the military was run. There was a kind of reign of terror of you know, Hitler's inner circle people watching all that was going on. And I guess the best example of that was Rommel, who got involved in the plot to bring down Hitler. And he was eventually told that as they knew he was involved, he should either commit suicide or he would have a trial and something bad would happen to his family. And he did the honorable thing and he committed suicide. Now, are we seeing the beginnings of this in the US? I really have no idea, but it is alarming to think that it even might be something that a reasoning person would say is a possibility.
Exactly right. And of course, we don't know which way the hammer is falling at this point and whether or not this is something that will benefit Obama or go against Obama. We don't know who is doing this, if anyone is behind it. So there's a lot of speculation, but I imagine we'll see that being played out in the news in the coming days and weeks. But let's move on then. Let's turn to an email that I received today from a listener who is in Canada and has some friends who have a bit of money. There's a VP of a major company, but they are worried about protecting their wealth, and they're contemplating, for example, about where to go. And this person writes, should we go to New Zealand or Switzerland? And looking at house prices, where their friends and herself are living is in Silicon Valley. So just looking and comparing that to Switzerland, as she says, it's a freaking bargain because Swiss house prices are so extraordinary. Give us your own take on relocation, relocating to Switzerland specifically or other places for people of means. What is a place that do you think people can go to actually protect their wealth in this time?
Yeah, well, as someone who relocated to Switzerland 30 years ago on a skiing holiday and lost the return ticket and never came back, and who is now a Swiss national, I guess for me, I voted with my feet compared to what the UK was at the time I left. So yes, Switzerland is a very nice place to live. However, you have to look at, again, the fact that when I came here 30 years ago, the geopolitical balances were completely tipped in Switzerland's favor. It is today a very expensive country, that's for sure. I mean, real estate is, you know, even normal kind of residence is about $1,000 a square foot. So you can do your arithmetic if you want a nice house. A nice apartment, and land costs an absolute fortune because there really is so little of it. So, yes, Switzerland is an attractive place. It depends where you go. If you take Geneva, for example, I find that Geneva is pretty much a socialist state within a state. It is massively in debt. If you actually looked at the debt per capita of the canton of Geneva, it is the same as you would expect to find in the U.S., the 300,000 inhabitants, and there's over $10 billion worth of debt. So, I mean, these are staggering numbers, which people never, ever think about. I mentioned the issue also of jokingly about crime in the center of Geneva, that you might get your telephone stolen. But since the Schengen Accords have come in, it's become a pretty dangerous place. I'm very careful where my kids go out now in the center of town, or even if I let them go out. So those are issues. And then, of course, again, you take the taxes. Now, if you come to Switzerland with a very large amount of capital, you can cut a pretty good deal for yourself. But if you come with a moderate to good amount of capital, like a senior executive of a company, and you end up staying somewhere like Geneva or very nearby, you're going to find yourself paying maybe 50% in income taxes, and a very significant percentage of a tax on your personal fortune. Now, if you paid tax of 1% of the value of your fortune a few years ago, that wasn't so terrible. But when your fortune is now earning 0.5% at the bank, it is a real hammer blow. So I think you have that as a kind of extreme situation. There are other parts of Switzerland where the tax rates and conditions are completely different. Some of the country cantons around Zurich, for example, you can get very low tax rates, and it makes a huge amount of difference. However, finding work there is not very easy, and access in and out can become slightly more problematic. So, yeah, Switzerland is a possibility. It does have the political stability. It's very handy in terms of location for getting around the rest of Europe if you happen to want to get around Europe. But it's not without its drawbacks as well. And I have to say, you know, I'm looking at the moment as I'm living in the Geneva area. I'm looking at exactly the situation and saying, all right, well, what do I do? Do I take an apartment in some other part of Switzerland and get away from the socialist states of the West Switzerland, or do you then look at doing something completely exotic and getting somewhere in the other side of the world? Now, I mean, there are all the countries. You can have Costa Rica, you can have Belize. I mean, Mexico, the choices are unlimited, and I don't know too much about them. But the better the tax deals you get, the more problematic the location is, as a general rule.
That's right. I mean, it raises to me the question of relocation in general, and whether or not I always wonder if people think that relocation is some sort of cure-all for the potential problems that are coming, because obviously we are looking at a potential collapse of the global economy. I don't think there's going to be a place that's going to be sheltered from that particularly. And I wonder if people put too much faith in the idea of relocation as some sort of cure-all for their economic woes.
Yeah. Well, I think the trouble is the governments are now working in such a way to kind of defeat relocation as a solution. And we're seeing a lot of that at the moment in Switzerland, because money that is parked here by people who have nationalities, most of the European nationalities, is now subject to being taxed at source, or even part of the capital that you have confiscated if the money is still here in a few years' time. There's legislation in the pipeline like that at the moment. Then you take the American situation, where you're taxed on a worldwide basis and will betide you if you don't declare or if you get caught. So relocation per se, you have to define exactly the reasons you want to do it. Now, if you happen to live in a bad neighborhood in Detroit, I mean, no doubt the reasons are extremely practical of security. Then yes, then get away. But no doubt if you lived in a gated compound in Naples in Florida or something like that, you'd be probably as safe as you would be in Switzerland. And you're also, you know, you're staying close to your culture, because to adapt to a foreign country, especially just picking up your roots and moving, takes a long time. I mean, you've done it in Japan. I've done it in several countries, and it's not an overnight process, and many people fail in the exercise because their family doesn't accept it, or their spouse doesn't accept it, or their career opportunities mean that they have to move somewhere else.
That's right. It's definitely not a decision to take lightly, and I don't think it should only ever be done for an economic reason. I think there has to be a lot of different reasons and angles on that. Well, I think we're running out of time for today's conversation, but perhaps we can wrap up. You can tell people a little bit more about your website and the services you offer.
Very good. Okay. Yes, my website is the GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. I do radio broadcasts, interviews such as the interview today, and sometimes I do direct posts, mainly on subjects which are of concern or interest. I tend to do about one a week, sometimes a little bit more. My own main business is giving people business advice, which I tend to do for corporations or high net worth individuals or family offices. And obviously, if you go on the Geneva Business Insider Blogspot, you will find links to my business blogspot. And if anything I've said is of interest or I might be able to help you, I'd be only too pleased to do so.
Excellent. All right, let's leave it there for this month. But David, always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure once again. Thank you.